Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dark Dive, the podcast that delves into the depths of the dark web. My name is Aidan Murphy, and I'm your host as each episode we look at different aspects of the dark web. In the podcast feed, you can already find the entire limited series. In other episodes, we look at how the dark web works and areas of the dark web like marketplaces, hacking forums, and ransomware leak sites. But in this episode, we're going to look at what I call dark web service providers, by which I mean the wider ecosystem of services like crypto mixers, dark web search engines that support many of the marketplaces and forums we've discussed over the past four episodes. This is a term that, as far as I can tell, no one else has adopted. But here today to help me coin the term dark web service providers are two cybersecurity experts that are engrossed in the ecosystem of the dark web. Rob Fitzsimons, lead threat intelligence engineer at Searchlight Cyber. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Aidan. Thanks for having us.
And Kalito Persky, senior threat intelligence analyst at Searchlight Cyber. Hello, Kalito.
Hello, hello.
So I'm just going to ask you to really quickly introduce yourself to our listeners. We'll start with you, Rob, if you don't mind just telling everybody what you're about.
Hi, so my name is Rob Fitzsimons. Thanks for the introduction, Aidan. I have a background as coming up through my cybersecurity career as an intelligence analyst within the British Army. Gave me incredible insights as to not only the fundamental aspects of intelligence, how it works and why it's so important and how that intelligence element relates to cybersecurity, but also being able to pull through to understand how it really can be leveraged to a good effect within a operational requirement. After leaving the military, I worked for a number of years at a network monitoring security provider. And then since that, I've been working at Searchlight Cyber for almost 2 years now. So had a lot of time to explore all the intricacies of the dark web, trying to understand why people are using it and the different things that may be happening within that environment.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rob. And Carlito, if you don't mind just saying a word on yourself for our listeners.
Well, my name's Carlito. Coming out of university, finishing my degree in criminology, I spent 3 years working for the Yorkshire and Humber Regional Organized Crime Unit, one of the civilian investigators. I spent a lot of time focusing on cryptocurrency-based investigations, tracking crypto through the blockchain, people's ill-gotten gains, things of that nature. After the stint there, I spent about 9 months at PayPal, working on their crypto SAR department, so filing suspicious activity reports for PayPal and helping build out the crypto wing there, and then a small stint in fraud before landing here in Searchlight for the best part of, I think, maybe 4 or 5 months now.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to be talking about cryptocurrency, so you're the right person to be talking to. Looking at the wider ecosystem of the dark web, I think it really is the place to start. So just to bring you guys up to speed, in our very first episode, our CTO, Dr. Gareth Owenson, laid out his theory, I guess, or his viewpoint that the dark web really took a turn when cryptocurrency became more mainstream and suddenly a quite niche maybe area of the internet was compounded with a way to pay for illicit services. I guess I might ask each of you first, did you agree with that assessment? Has cryptocurrency spurred on the cybercriminal community? I'll ask you first, maybe Carlito.
Yeah, absolutely. Traditionally, like, committing crimes and transferring funds from one another would either be done through cash in hand, actually meeting individuals, or through banking systems. The KYC for banking systems today is like incredibly good. It's very difficult for you to sign up with fraudulent details, things of that nature. Using mules is incredibly common in that area of crime. But cryptocurrencies sort of circumvent the majority of that. The ability to send funds to someone in another country, where there might be sanctions in place, just the other side of the world, within the space of 10, 15 minutes, which is not anonymous, but pseudo-anonymous is the best way, really helped like shape the future of how online crime is, especially in the dark web ecosystem.
Brilliant. Robin, before I just kind of pull off on Kalito on some of the points you made there, do you have a viewpoint on that, on how cryptocurrency is kind of fueling, I guess, the crime you see day to day in your work?
Yeah, so I was just going to touch on a point that Carlito raised regarding the sort of pseudo-anonymity associated with cryptocurrencies. Ultimately, the majority of the criminals that are leveraging the dark web utilize it for its anonymity and the element of privacy that it is perceived to give them. So not only operating in a global manner, being able to hide the element of where they're distributing it from, where they're distributing it to, has always been an element of attraction around the dark web. So bringing cryptocurrency into that, that provides that, again, element of additional anonymity, privacy around people's payments, helps to further secure their transactions, further secure their activities, and also gives the facade of added impunity against all of their actions that they're having on the dark web. So it kind of goes hand in hand that any additional capabilities that are going to provide a higher level of anonymity to these individuals is going to potentially be sought and leveraged to its full effect.
I'm really interested in this anonymity element, but just before I get onto that, I think it would be good to give the listener a sense of, you know, how often do we see cryptocurrency on the dark web? How prevalent is it? And what are people using it to pay for? Rob, maybe you can comment on that. You spend a lot of time kind of looking at it's part of your job, obviously, investigating this kind of activity. Yeah, can you give a sense of the scale of the use of cryptocurrency?
Where do we start? It's like currency in the wider world, right? Whether it's the US dollars, British pounds, it is the currency of the dark web, whether it's Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, whatever people may be using, they are leveraging it for almost any purchase on the dark web. So some of the things I know have been talked about in the podcast previously, leveraging crypto to buy gold bars and bars of silver on the dark web, anything from that to, you know, buying drugs for whatever reason you may want them, to hiring a hitman and anything in between. Cryptocurrency is the currency of choice on the dark web these days.
And paying for ransomware payments as well, I imagine, is quite a big one.
And paying for ransomware payments, yeah.
You mentioned a few different cryptocurrencies there. Carlito, a question I would have at the solicitor is there a cryptocurrency of choice for criminal deeds, or does it not matter to them? It's just whichever cryptocurrency they favor in general.
I think it depends on the type of criminal you're dealing with. Perhaps newer or maybe old hat, I suppose you could call them, would probably take the majority. Bitcoin is sort of the hugest among the most of these, just due to how prevalent it is in society. If you ask anyone about cryptocurrencies, if they know anything about it, they'll be like, oh yeah, that's sort of the Bitcoin thing, isn't it? But there are individuals who maybe are working as nation state actors or things along that nature, and who are a bit more privy to understanding how blockchain tracing can work, and will use more privacy-focused coins, things like Monero, things like Litecoin, Zcash, things of that nature.
Interesting. So this brings us on to the anonymity element, and I'm not very au fait with cryptocurrency, so I'm going to ask what might be the stupid question, but my understanding is cryptocurrency works on the blockchain, and the blockchain is a ledger. In theory, it should be pretty transparent. Why is cryptocurrency more anonymous than fiat payments?
So while everything is on there, on the ledger, it's available to see the X address is paid Y address, things of that nature. There's firstly sort of a degree of illiteracy with the majority of people. You're sort of in this community or out of it. If you understand what these payments mean and the ability to trace them, you're sort of golden. But there's this wall for people sort of trying to come in and understand that initially. Secondly, unless you have a starting point, you're not really able to identify where these addresses are tagged as. You can see that X address has paid X amount to Y address, or, you know, clusters of addresses, but without understanding who either of these addresses are, where they've been located, who they can be tied to, it's just like saying, you know, Bob Jenkins has sent £2 to Susie Smith. It doesn't really mean anything to anyone without any context.
So it's difficult to tie a real world persona or identity to a cryptocurrency wallet.
Yeah, absolutely. That's sort of the majority of the work that's done. The ability to sort of drag these individuals who try and hide behind these pseudonymities out into the light and be able to tie them to real world identities is sort of the base of what we do.
And you mentioned before, you know, your customer systems that regular, I guess, traditional financial services have in place. And then this, I guess, is designed to make it more difficult to conduct fraud, criminal activity with that money. Cryptocurrencies don't have as stringent know your customer? I know some of them do, but as stringent know your customer kind of policies and things in place, systems?
Crypto regulations are sort of changing every year. Recently, I think the start of 2023, the UAE banned the use of these types of privacy-focused coins, or maybe banned is a bit of a strong word, but you need to be able to prove to the government where you've obtained these funds from, which sort of removes the anonymity element of it. But the most large crypto exchanges, do places like Binance, Coinbase, things of that nature, have very stringent KYC policies in place, where maybe in the early 2010s, you could go to local Bitcoins, people would have mined their own Bitcoins, they'll then transfer them peer-to-peer. There's no sign-up information to change those. There was sort of a, it was a very different time from where we're living currently.
Interesting. So it's an industry on the change then. One thing I think listeners might be wondering is whether there's anything the cryptocurrency industry should be doing to combat the use of these currencies for crime, if it is as prevalent as, well, we know it's prevalent as we say it is very prevalent. Is there not something that they should be doing about it, or is it not their priority or their belief that they have a responsibility in monitoring how this currency is used?
It's interesting because as the industry has been evolving, it's sort of evolved from a place of where there were no regulations in place, and as businesses operating for profit, they don't have to do anything. You know, why would they not want to take these funds in, take their part of the transaction fee and pay them out? But as governments have become more privy, as dark web sales have gone up, as this has sort of become a little bit more mainstream, as you'd like to say, governments have pushed, put a lot of pressure on bodies like the European Union as well for these to make regulation changes and enforce a more stringent KYC for people who are paying out. They additionally have sort of their own in-house tools for analyzing where payments have come from, if they come from places like known marketplaces, scam sites, things of that nature. They might reject them or take them in, hold the payment, and ask for specific information. There are also a lot more contacts within these exchanges for the ability for law enforcement bodies around the world to get in contact, get this information for people that they believe who have tried to launder sort of stolen or illicit gained funds via these means.
I want to go back a step maybe and look a bit how cyber criminals use them, because I guess you can imagine it as a closed ecosystem. So if you run a drugs market, for example, you get people to pay in cryptocurrency, and then you have this bucket of money that sits there. But presumably there is at some point a need for the criminals to cash out in order to be able to use this money. How does that element work? How can they go about cashing out without drawing attention to themselves, I guess, for a huge amount of cryptocurrency they've amassed maliciously?
That's always sort of the question, isn't it? Okay, it's amazing that I've managed to gain X amount of funds through these illicit activities, but now how do I launder this effectively sort of into the system? A lot of the ways that people do is the main way to try and obfuscate the source of funds. So they'll either swap chains, transfer them to a different type of coin, or they'll use the services of mixers, things of that nature, just again to assist with the obfuscation of where the funds have come from.
So you've brought up something that I wanted to touch on. So crypto mixers. How do crypto mixers work?
So essentially, it's sort of a very large pool of funds. You'll transfer them X amount of Bitcoins, we'll say one for argument's sake. You'll tell them where in which they're going to deposit the funds out, and they'll send the funds to the address and within this large pool. So the aim of it is sort of with the mass amount of these transactions is to say it with a greater difficulty that person A has sent funds to person B due to this intermediary source, as well as sort of is transaction A actually going to transaction B? If there are maybe hundreds, thousands of people putting in one Bitcoin at a time, and there are thousands of people on the other side also gaining a Bitcoin, how are you supposed to say that A and B are connected?
Just to add to Carlito's point there, it's money laundering, right? Something that has been happening for, as long as I know. People, particularly criminals, are gaining money through some sort of illicit service, but they want to be able to utilize that money to pay for actual goods and make it look like legitimate currency. Money laundering has been going on forever, and there's always been capabilities to do that, whether it's going to a casino or something, look at making it look like winnings, through to Walter White in Breaking Bad sell an additional air fresheners for every car wash that goes through. Ultimately, the technological advancement of cryptocurrency has just shifted that focus from a physical currency through to the digital currency. And it's given that additional capability to criminals to continue to conduct their malicious, illicit services on a dark web, continue to have that ease of money laundering, if you will, because they still don't need to have access to it. They can transport it digitally to any of these mixers or tumblers, wherever they want to in the world, whichever one's potentially better or is not being viewed at that particular time, and ultimately get that money to where they want to, as Carlisa was saying, have that information or that currency exfiltrated into whichever account it needs to be, and it ultimately looks like legitimate transactions.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's effectively sophisticated money laundering. And I think we've come across this a few times on the podcast already, that we're effectively seeing traditional, as you say, Rob, exactly right, traditional criminal services effectively just having a dark web counterpoint, maybe more sophisticated, sometimes quite rudimentary, really, you know, exactly the same technique being used, just different words around it. You've mentioned that there is, I guess, a side part of the cybersecurity industry that does focus on tracing these illicit payments. And I noticed looking at mixers, there are a couple of examples like Blender and Chip Mixer that are no longer with us, that they have been taken down by law enforcement. Rob, I don't know, maybe if you could talk a little bit about how the cybersecurity industry is tackling the use of cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we understand we are seeing people use it, and there is ways of monitoring and understand where those transactions are going. Ultimately, there's pieces of information that have to be shared actively. So as Carlito mentioned earlier, if you're making a payment, it needs to go into a crypto wallet, for example. Now, we often see, particularly on the sort of criminal side of the dark web, individuals in markets or in forums, they ultimately want to be paid, right? There's a selling service, they need to be paid. The question is, where do we get paid to? That answer to that question is their crypto wallet, which they will have a specific reference to, and they ultimately share, which could be on a private message, and through something like Telegram, or it can be commonly listed on the bottom of their market. Say, this is my crypto address, this is how much I want for this product, send it to this wallet. They're pieces of information as they stand individually, but we can start leveraging those pieces of information. Say, okay, potentially, if we take the wallet example, where else have we seen this wallet? Are we seeing multiple individuals leveraging the same wallet? In such a case, it could be same individual under multiple aliases. It could be a single wallet leveraged by a larger organized criminal group. Regardless of how it's being leveraged, we understand that there is a wallet that is potentially receiving funds by some sort of malicious actor. What we can start doing then is leveraging digital tools such as chain analysis or Elliptic, who offer capabilities to start enabling investigations into the blockchain. So again, as Carlito was referencing earlier, being able to monitor and follow those transactions through the digital ledgers to understand where the money is coming and going and understand where it's potentially being shared and potentially who this information or this currency is being attributed to.
Yeah, so I saw chain analysis, I think we can name, as they're a friend of Searchlight. And what they do complements what we do quite nicely. But they effectively, from what I understand, start flagging accounts that are tied to criminal activities. And I guess if you're a law enforcement officer or a cybersecurity professional, maybe investigating a ransomware group or something like that, building these profiles and attaching them to specific cryptocurrency accounts and that kind of information, like you say, you start to kind of accumulate a body of evidence. Is that the right way of looking at it?
Yeah, I would say that's fair to say. Ultimately, it's about evidence, and it's about, we're talking about the law enforcement side of things, it's all about investigations, right? In particular around the cryptocurrency, it's fraudulent or for financial investigations. So again, going from where it used to be, trying to understand which money is being transferred from which accounts and who's potentially taken out in the Cayman Islands, it's looking more specifically in that digital perspective to see, okay, which wallets are these cryptocurrencies going to and from? Again, trying to conduct those investigations in an effective way within this digital remit.
So it's possible, but would it be fair to say that it's cryptocurrencies have made law enforcement's job much more difficult? I can see, Carlito, you're nodding very vigorously.
Yes, I think it's the point that I sort of touched on earlier is that whenever there are these new and emerging, and again, sort of air quotes in new and emerging, as it's been around since the early 2010s, and while there have been individuals who have sort of delved into this area, it sort of hasn't been as widespread for the use of payments of goods and things of that nature since maybe sort of 2017 onwards. It presents a challenge for something new that sort of the layman has to understand to a certain degree. When a police officer goes through the house of a drug dealer and he sees 1XY3GB4, you know, ongoing written on his desk, he is like, oh, that's weird. That there's this new sort of understanding that they have to be aware that, oh, this could be a cryptocurrency address. Perhaps he's taking funds through cryptocurrency. Perhaps there's a lot of money we don't know about. Things of this nature. There's also a whole new demand for a whole new set of skills that really need to come in. So while it's great, maybe you could accumulate that these individuals have cryptocurrency, say, okay, then what? There needs to be people in this remit who understand and are capable of using this information to leverage it and help with convictions.
Yeah. And I guess there's also the added element of, like you say, in inverted commas, newer technology, that perhaps the regulation and everything else around it isn't quite there yet as well. Is that the case, or has the industry come on further around that in terms of really legislating to stop the use of cryptocurrencies for illegal activity?
For where we are at the moment, I'd say the majority of large exchanges are doing a pretty good job. They have very stringent KYC policies I've touched on earlier, and they have their own in-house tools. They adhere to pretty strict regulations, and I'm pretty sure there are rumblings of regulations are going to get a bit tighter as well. They do a pretty good job of keeping to these. So I think currently from where they're at, I think they're doing a pretty good job.
Okay. So just before we move on from crypto mixes, are they strictly illegal? Are there any use cases in which they're acceptable, or really is it if you're operating a crypto mixer, you are under the watch of law enforcement?
I think as long as you're using it for the correct purposes, right? It's a tool like any other. It's the ability to transfer funds anonymously from X to Y in the way that sort of you can make anonymous donations to charity and things of that nature. Anonymous transactions aren't inherently bad. It's when they're abused that's sort of the issue. Maybe if you're a journalist and you have some sources that you want to pay money to for whistleblowing information, and you want to ensure that their safety is there, the ability to sort of help anonymize your payments to them while, you know, crypto is already a good additional step. You want to take every step possible to protect your sources. That would be sort of one pretty strong example. Or it countries where their currencies aren't particularly stable, places like maybe Venezuela is a pretty good example, where their currency fluctuates almost daily, I believe. The ability for this universal currency to be able to hold its value when maybe sending money home to family or to provide aid is also like quite a handy tool.
So very like the dark web itself in a way that nothing really inherently bad in the technology, but it's the way it's used that is strays into the illegal or ethically questionable.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's no really bad things, just bad people.
Just bad people. At this point, I think I might move us on to the idea of dark web search engines, because it's an interesting topic. So again, going back to episode one, Gareth said one of the key elements of the dark web is that the sites are not indexed on search engines, and not to call our co-founder a liar at this, the fifth episode of the series, but there are search engines on the dark web. Rob, I guess, what's going on there? Can you explain that?
Gareth just messaged me and said he'd like a chat with you after this. Yeah, it's an interesting, I think you referred to it as an interesting paradox in the dark web, like something that is ultimately designed for anonymity and ultimately hide everything away. All of a sudden, you're starting to see dark web search engines, which are trying to index certain sites, forums, and markets and enable people to find what it is that they're looking for. And this is an element, maybe an element of a challenge within the dark web. Whilst people are using it, again, there's some legitimate reasons for accessing the dark web. The majority of what we see and what we deal with is for illegitimate reasons. It's people selling illicit goods, as we touched on earlier, you know, trying to sell anything from drugs to weapons to, again, hitmen for hire. It's a service, right, that they're ultimately trying to sell. You cannot sell anything in this world without somebody being aware of it. So ultimately, if you're not making yourself visible, if no one can find you, you're going to have a load of product, whatever that product may be, and you can't shift it. So ultimately, there is, I believe, a bit of a gravity towards having things like dark web search engines to make certain markets and certain forums more visible, easier to find for people who are sort of fairly new to the dark web, don't necessarily know how to search it, but ultimately they can get on and they can find what it is they're looking for and potentially make a purchase and take advantage of those services being offered.
Yeah, I think the listeners are going to be sick of me talking about the dark web paradox, but I do think there's no other way to describe this. It's back to that idea of wanting to use the dark web for its anonymity, but like you said, they're trying to sell something, so there has to be a degree of being found. And I was shocked when I started working here. Someone told me that dark web search engines even have advertisers, sponsored ads, like you might get on Google or Bing, which is slightly crazy in my mind, that in one hand they're using the dark web to avoid detection, and in the other hand they're paying for advertising. Rob, can you give the listener maybe an idea of what does the dark web search engine look like? Are we literally talking kind of a knockoff version of Google? If someone visited a dark web search engine, which we would not recommend, what would they see?
Yeah, I would say you're not far off, to be fair. Think of Google search engine, but in one of its earlier iterations. So kind of like dial-up versions of the internet. It's all a little bit dated, a little bit clunky. It works. It's a little bit slow, but ultimately, you know, it does get you to where you need to be, and it gives you some links and some references to areas that may be of relevance to you. It's not infallible. It's not the best search engine in the world. Ultimately, the dark web is an extremely volatile place. So a site that may be up today may be down tomorrow. So if you're finding a reference to that site on the search engine, you can go through dead link after dead link of just going onto forums and markets, which, you know, the search engine's found that link for you, but ultimately there's nothing behind it.
I was just going to ask Carlito, I guess there's also a risk of following unknown links on the dark web, an inherent risk of, I guess, using a search engine in that way.
Yeah, I suppose it always comes with the disclaimer that everything that's all advertised there, the dangers of this are really real. Anything that you wouldn't want to see on the clear web, things that are banned can crop up on there. So it's always important to be incredibly careful with A, protecting yourself from things like malware, but also ensuring that you're not seeing content that is upsetting or offensive to you, because there's an awful ton of that on there.
Yeah, I guess this is one of the inherent risks for researchers, security professionals who, as part of their job, they have to monitor the dark web, but it is an inherently dangerous place.
And also, you've got to consider the people, generally younger individuals who are new to the dark web. It sounds like a kind of cool place to go, you know? If you're a bunch of teenagers and you're thinking, oh, talking about in the playground, have we heard of the dark web? It is unbelievably accessible these days. And it's at risk where people like security researchers, threat intelligence analysts, investigators are often generally aware of these risks and have capabilities in place to hopefully protect them from the likes of activity that Carlito just referenced. But for people who are very new to it, who don't understand and don't have these backgrounds to be aware of some of the things that happen on there, they're the ones that potentially fall into the trap of seeing this horrible activity on a dark web that they really don't want to, And then that's associated with that additional risk, right? They've been on there, potentially stuff's got onto their systems, potentially malware or worse. And that starts to add an additional challenge to protecting certain individuals from, you know, almost an awareness piece, a broader awareness piece of making people understand what the dark web is and what the risks are associated with it, so they can better prepare themselves and, you know, maybe not go on there in the first instance, unless it is for a legitimate reason, particularly from a work perspective, and in which case they've got the tools and capabilities in place to protect things that they shouldn't be seeing.
There was a very large phase, not to out anyone here as being older than me or anything, but as a young man on the YouTubes and on the TikToks, there were these phases where individuals would create videos which were like, I ordered the $250,000 mystery box from the dark web. And these videos are obviously targeted at sort of younger audiences, creating this sort of air of mystery of like, oh, there was like a knife here with like a bit of ketchup on it. Maybe this was used in a murder, and things like this that really pique the curiosity of young individuals. And while it's cool and fun to do that for entertainment purposes, the ability to ensure that you're not pushing this on a young audience who are vulnerable is very important.
Absolutely. I mean, I hope everybody listening to our podcast would at this point be very aware of the dangers of the dark web and not to be looking to go for themselves, unless of course they're a cybersecurity professional and have all the proper parameters around them, and are doing it strictly for research and security purposes. Search engines, slightly problematic, as you said. You know, you could, the search function isn't great. They are quite dangerous. My understanding is that almost more popular on the dark web, I mean, talking really old school, are very simple sites. We might call them link sites, where you go and it's like an index of links to follow. Are either you kind of aware of those?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of these sites which are often just HTML pages with links attached to them saying this is how you get to sort of X place. Dread is a very large forum, which I'm sure at some point was touched on the podcast. All the large marketplaces that are going on, as well as other resources, you know, Wikipedia, BBC News, all have their own dark web marketplaces. They're all often on these places. One example off the top of my head is called tor.taxi, which is a website which does, you know, exactly as previously described.
So I was just going to add, like, ultimately these link sites are almost like a more easy to use version of the search engine, right? If you're looking for the search engine, you'll provide loads of links referencing the word or the term that you've looked for, which could be relevant, could not be. If you can find links to these sites, maybe by using the search engine, but something like Tor Taxi, you get on this page and you're no longer necessarily trying to go for the challenge of finding something of interest. It's kind of more readily presented to you. So you would have like categories maybe of forums, and it would be user maintained of the top five forums currently, all of them hyperlinked through to their audience. That could be markets, forums, crypto mixes, how to set up crypto addresses, wikis. There's all sorts of areas that can generally be quite useful. But again, from that sort of security research, threat intelligence perspective, if you know where these sites are, index them and you can leverage them for your own investigative purposes. But yeah, they can be handy for sure.
You've touched on something there, Rob, that I wanted to talk about in this episode. So we've had these previous episodes that focus on very specific areas of the dark web. It's the way I like to think of it. Marketplaces, forums, ransomware leak sites. It's quite easy to start to categorize these Tor sites into these buckets. But obviously the dark web is vast and has a lot of strange things on it that don't necessarily fit into these very clearly defined areas. I wanted to ask you guys, you know, what are the areas of the dark web that maybe our listeners won't have heard of before, won't have come across, maybe never want to come across, but should know about? I'll start with you, Carlito.
A personal one that really stood out to me was sort of maybe in my first 2 years of starting as an investigator for the Yorkshire and Humber Regional Organised Crime Unit was a website titled P-Pick of the Day. It was a web page with an image of an individual in a public stall. Nothing inherently poor about it, no genitalia or anything of that nature, just a picture of an individual in a public place to urinate.
That is a particularly strange area of the dark web, I would say. Did that come up in the course of an investigation, or
you know, on a, I believe with the time we called it horizon scanning, going and looking at new websites and justifying if there was any investigative lines there. To a degree, I suppose you could, but there was no other real information unless you were particularly good at identifying what, you know, bathroom tiles look like, perhaps, and where they could be located in certain countries. A very niche set of skills, which unfortunately I didn't manage to cultivate in my time.
Rob, areas of the dark web that maybe the listener may not have come across or heard of before.
So I do have a particular favour on this, which I fortunately stumbled across after a sort of slightly investigation, a slightly darker side of the dark web. So I needed something a little bit more uplifting and not necessarily what you would assume to be on a dark web. It was a site called Get Gnomed, as in a little garden gnome that you would have. And it doesn't exist anymore. The site's down, unfortunately. But essentially, it was a fairly humorous service. It was supposedly being provided from the dark web, where they had different categories, and you could essentially request the service to have an individual, be it a friend or an enemy, gnomed in some way, shape, or form. And if I remember right, they had, say, multiple services. One of the lower tiers started at about $500. So you could get an individual gnome. It would simply be their front lawn would be filled with gnomes, which, kind of humorous. I imagine it would be infuriating if it happened to me. But, you know, you tidy them up and this sort of forgotten about. The increments in tiers had, I think one was called something like Cursed Gnomes or Gnome Haunting. And you'd start off with a single gnome. If you remove that, the next day there'd be two, and then four, and then eight, and they'd multiply day after day to essentially, you know, kind of terrorize someone in one of the nicest and most harmless ways possible. It was quite weird. But to go back to one of the points that Carlito made earlier, I'm pretty sure, and you know, you can find this widely reported on the internet, it does seem like a hoax. I mean, I can't imagine anybody's going to spend $500 to try and get a bunch of garden gnomes put in their friend's garden. But this started and was widely covered on TikTok by an individual. And it seems like they probably started off initially, started recording it and try and get a load of traction. They made loads of videos, hundreds of thousands of views. But as I say, that point that Carlito made earlier, that sounds really interesting. It was went viral. It's an insight into the dark web that a lot of people don't see. And a really lighthearted insight into the dark web, which can often be that stepping stone for people trying to get into it and then ultimately go down certain avenues and find other things that they potentially weren't looking for. But yeah, for me, Get Gnomed's probably the best site on the dark web.
I'd never heard of that before. That's fascinating and sounds like a horror movie. I'm not sure that is an innocent use of the dark web, to be honest. I would be terrified if a collection of gnomes appeared on my doorstep every morning. I guess both of your stories illustrate that there are just weird, quite funny use cases out there. You have both also drawn out the more serious element. Am I just finished off by asking, why is it important that people know about these areas of the dark web, maybe not the gnome site, but in particular about what is out there and what's on the dark web? From your perspective, why is it relevant to them, Rob?
From my perspective and the investigations that I've been involved in and this sort of use case that a number of our customers are involved in, there is a growing criminal activity within the dark web ecosystem. We see a lot of activity, again, relating to things like the crypto addresses. It is being leveraged for more, provide that pseudo-anonymity around these activities. It's allowing people to more readily access sites, buy services, conduct criminal and malicious illicit activities. And ultimately, there are things happening. Everything from ransomware groups or threat actors developing exploits through to, you know, data being released on the dark web after a company's been breached and anything in between. And it's all of those pieces combined, depending on your specific use case, that you can start deriving value from. Investigating an individual, monitoring a ransomware group, understanding what's happening so that we can ultimately have informed decisions about what we may need to do to, from a cybersecurity perspective, protect our organizations, from a law enforcement perspective, identify individuals, track activities, and understand what is happening.
Brilliant. Okay, well, in the next episode, we're going to look at what cybersecurity professionals and law enforcement can do to crack down on the more criminal element. So again, if you're interested in that, stay tuned. You can find that episode already in your podcast feed. But this seems like a good time to draw a line under this episode of The Dark Dive. A big thank you to Rob and Carlita for joining me. And if you can't wait to find out more, remember to follow us for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and whatever podcast app you have on your device. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Searchlight Cyber, you can find our social media accounts and email address in the show notes, or you can find plenty of information on our website, www.slcyber.io. Until next time, stay safe.